1930s, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation through a series of radio broadcasts known as the Fireside Chats. His aim was to reassure the common man that our society would recover from its troubled times. Well, we're far from 1930, and I deal with a different kind of fire. For a new era of worldly frustration, we offer a fresh conversation. I'm Greg Carlwood, and these are the Fireside Chats.
All right, listen up, people. 80 years ago, deep in a mine in Copper Canyon, Mexico, a 900-year-old human-like skull was found, now known as the Starchild Skull. What's interesting about this skull is the numerous differences between it and a typical human skull. Some consider this skull to be the smoking gun evidence that we've been visited by extraterrestrials, and today I'm excited to have a chat with the Chief Operating Officer of the Starchild Project, Amy Vickers, here to talk about what the hell this thing is. Amy, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me on.
My pleasure. I'm glad that you are willing to do this. I've been fascinated with the mystery surrounding the skull since I've first seen it pop up on, I think it was UFO Hunters. I've also seen it on Coast to Coast AM, and I'm psyched to hear the latest from the Starchild Project. But first, can you paint a picture for us of the details under which the Starchild skull was discovered?
Sure thing. It was actually found by an American tourist in Mexico, as you said, in the 1930s. She basically found it in a mine tunnel. It's a little macabre, but she just found it along with another full skeleton. She was only able to recover the two skulls. One of them is the Starchild, one of them is a normal skull. She brought them back with her to the States and basically kept them as a souvenir her entire life, just thinking, well, this is a really unusual skull and this is a normal skull and this is from my holiday in Mexico. And when she was getting on in life and knew that she would be dying soon, she passed them on to friends, to pass them on to friends, and then they passed them on to Ray and Melanie Young, the current owners of the skull. Melanie was a neonatal nurse, so she took an immediate interest wanting to know what kind of deformity it was, if it even was a deformity, because she'd never seen anything nearly as unusual as this skull. And so Melanie and her husband Ray started asking around, trying to find someone that would take a serious look at it, and they ended up settling on Lloyd Pye. And together they founded the Starchild Project in early 1999. And the Starchild Project is just an informal organization of people who arranged to have the skull tested by different independent facilities. And that's what's been going on with it for about 12 years now, since 99, just test after test after test, every time that funding permits and every time it makes sense, we've just thrown the kitchen sink at it.
Yeah, I've actually heard that through the various interviews that you've done and Lloyd's done, that I hear different numbers between 10 and 25 major differences between the Starchild and a human skull.
There's absolutely 25 major differences. Everything from the bone being at least as half as thick and at least twice as durable as normal human bone, to the shape of the skull being radically different, the position of the neck on the skull being basically impossible for you or me or any other normal kind of human, to things that we found inside the bone of the skull, microscopic fibers woven through the matrix of the bone of the skull, like steel rebar reinforcing concrete. And also not necessarily microscopic, but very, very hard to see with the naked eye. We found a reddish residue inside the cancellous holes of the skull. Now, the cancellous holes is where your bone marrow usually is. So you would think, well, it's red residue. It must just be desiccated bone marrow. Mm-hmm. Well, after 900 years, there should be nothing left in those cancellous holes. And even if it was blood or bone marrow, there's no way it would still be red. It would be black. So we've had different mycologists and other experts look at it to try and figure out whether it's some kind of fungus or mold or what it could be, and they're all absolutely baffled by it. There should be nothing left inside the bone after 900 years. The natural bacteria should have eaten all of it. So we have something here that seems to be immune to natural biological decomposition on this planet. And so, I mean, that just on its own is enormous. But then when you combine it with the fibers that no one has ever seen in any bone anywhere before, you combine that with the unusual shape of the skull, the qualities of the strength and thinness and lightness of the bone, it's just off the charts. There is no combination of deformities that you can come up with that would make a human be born with a skull like this and somehow survive not just long enough to grow teeth, but long enough to grind its teeth down with use, which is the case with the Starchild skull.
Now, a lot of the interviews I see about the Starchild skull, they waste a lot of time trying to explain it away with various human conditions, whether it be cradle boarding or water on the brain or some other kind of deformity. But these fibers and the thickness of the skull alone, not to mention that the thing looks like a goddamn alien, these things are to me, pretty impressive facts that go well beyond just the general shape of the skull, which is weird-looking enough. But I've heard some kind of weird things happen when the skull was tested for durability and cut for samples for testing. Can you tell us what those things might have been?
Absolutely. Now, you mentioned seeing UFO hunters. There's actually been a number of documentaries that the skull has been on. And recently they tried to actually do a hardness test on television. They got a hardness meter, which is basically a device where you punch a hole through something and it tells you how much force was required to punch a hole through it.
Okay.
Well, that's testing compression strength. The strength of the Starchild skull, while it did measure higher than normal bone on that compression test, the strength that we have is not so much just strength, how much it takes to crush it, it's durability. I mean, your bones aren't there to stop you from being crushed. They're there to not break under tensile pressure when they get bent. The Starchild skull bone has those fibers going through it that give it, or we theorize that they give it strength and flexibility as well. So even though that puncture test that they tried to do only registered it being somewhat higher than normal human bone, when they went to cut the bone samples out of the skull for the first time, they used a small rotary cutting saw. It's a little electric saw with a circular blade that's made of tungsten carbide, which is the same kind of metal that your dentist's drill bits are made out of. Mm-hmm. So they cut, again, we have two skulls found in the same mine tunnel. They're the same age, 900 years old. So we usually use that normal skull as a control against the Starchild skull,
right,
just in case there's any kind of degradation. They use that blade to cut through the normal skull, and it just cut it like butter. That's what it's there for. It just cut right through it like it was nothing. They got a clean blade of the same kind and went to cut the Starchild skull. It literally bounced off the bone. They could not get it to cut with any degree of ease. In the end, they did manage to get it to cut, and we ended up switching to a diamond-coated blade. But this isn't normal kind of strength. This is something unbelievable in this bone that's giving it properties that are very hard to explain.
Yeah, that's to me one of the most interesting things. As far as the fibers are concerned, do we know what the fibers are made of? Like, I mean, they're apparently anomalous to this planet. Like, there's no fibers in any other bone, as far as I've heard from other various interviews, correct?
You're absolutely correct. There is a condition called Morgellons that it's medically unclassified. The medical associations haven't said it's an official disease yet. It does cause fibers in the skin. And they're about 10 times larger than the fibers found inside the Starchild skull bone. But nothing in the actual bone. Morgellons doesn't give you fibers inside the bone. No condition gives you fibers inside the bone like we have in the case of the Starchild skull. This is so far out there. This is so dissimilar from anything that's ever been seen before. We can't tell you what those fibers are. We have to invent a protocol to be able to pull those fibers out of the bone, and then we can test them and find out what they are. But there isn't even a test invented yet. There isn't some method, some system to get those fibers out of the bone, because nothing like this has ever been seen before. There's never been a call for it. So we really have something that's not just really interesting, it's really unique.
Right. And this you said before the skull was found with another skeleton of a woman, I've heard. Are these two related, or do we have any idea, like, why they were, you know, found together, or why they were together? Is the Starchild skull a child?
We aren't sure if it's a child. We have conflicting evidence on that. Some aspects of the skull point to a child of 5 or 6. Other aspects point to someone that's older, you know, somewhere around the age of 21 to 25. Other aspects point to someone much older. So we're really at kind of an impasse. A number of our experts are just sure it's a child, and then we have others that are positive it's an adult. So that's up in the air. But it was named the Star Child when the only test that had been done on it were x-rays, and they showed that it had somewhat childlike teeth, and so that's what we based it off of. So it may have been a child. The woman, you're absolutely correct, she was a woman found with the skull, is not genetically related to it at all. It's not to say she couldn't be an adoptive mother, but they aren't genetically related in any way. And the fact that they were found together does make us think that there is some kind of emotional connection between the two, but we just don't know what that is at this point. But we are so happy to have a control skull, because early on in the process, I mentioned the bone is literally half as thick and weighs half as much as normal human bone. Well, as bone ages over hundreds of years, it does get a tiny little bit thicker. Sorry, a tiny little bit thinner. Oops, slip of the tongue. Mm-hmm. It gets a little thinner over time. So one of the early excuses that people throw up is to say, well, that's just post-mortem contraction of the bone. That's just gotten thinner because it's older. And we have this other skull that's been in the exact same conditions that we could pull out and say, no, this is what posthumous bone contraction looks right. like. And so it's been a wonderful comparison for us at every step of the way.
And are there any clues to their relationship based on how they were found or anything like that?
Well, they were actually found in a very unusual situation. The entire skeleton of the Starchild skull was buried in a shallow grave. The entire skeleton of the human female skull was found above the ground next to it. And sticking up out of that shallow grave was the hand and forearm of the Starchild skull wrapped around her upper arm bone. So the only conclusion that we were able to draw from that is that she must have brought the Starchild being there, buried it, laid down next to it, wrapped the hand around her arm, and died herself. Because if someone had brought them there and buried them, then she would have been buried as well. If they had both crawled up there and died together, then she wouldn't have been able to bury it. The only story that fits the fact is that if she buried the Starchild being and then somehow died herself next to it, but felt such a strong attachment that she wanted to hold its hand or have it holding her arm for all eternity.
Are there any clues to how she died?
We don't know, unfortunately. With only having the skulls, we don't have any obvious head injuries. There is a healed concussion, a healed fracture on the skull of the human female. So she could have been just stark raving mad. We have no way of knowing this. But it was healed. She did not die from that injury. They died from something else. We just don't know what.
And that is just, this is just so crazy. I've heard from numerous interviews that the skull has been DNA tested, which seems to be obviously the most reliable way to figure out what is going on here. But I've heard that the mother was human, and then the father was a mystery. And now I've heard from a more recent interview on Coast to Coast that I understand that both parents are in question. What's the deal there?
Well, we have a policy at the Starchild Project of putting out information as soon as we have it. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes the result of that is we put things out before we have all of the facts, and we have to backtrack a little bit. When we did the first round of DNA testing, it was all the way back in 1999, that test was just a disaster. It was a complete contamination. The result that they got was that it was a 100% human male. And we released that information, and then in 2003, we found out that that test was contaminated. It was just wrong, because we did another test at a much more sophisticated lab that was designed for testing ancient DNA. And that test was able to recover maternal DNA, DNA from its mother, but no no DNA from the father. We knew there was DNA there. It's just looking for human DNA from the father, we weren't able to find any. And so the theory then became, well, it must have a human mother since we found a small amount of human maternal DNA. And maybe it has an alien father because we cannot find any paternal human DNA. And that's been our story since then. That's what the evidence that we had up until very recently told us. This latest round of DNA testing that we've done is even more sophisticated. DNA testing has just gone by leaps and bounds in the last few years. We've gone from the Stone Ages right up to the latest cutting-edge technology and what we're doing now. And these latest DNA tests recovered more of the maternal DNA. And that maternal DNA that was found in 2003 was indeed human, or at least close enough to human that we could identify it as being human.
Right.
But now that we have much more of the mother's DNA, we can see that parts of it are indeed human or very human-like, but much bigger parts are not. Much bigger parts are very, very, very unusual. There are two kinds of DNA in all of us. We've got mitochondrial DNA that's only from our mother and nuclear DNA that's from both parents. The nuclear DNA is what they talk about when they talk about the human genome. It's the thing that basically makes us individuals as we are. The mitochondrial DNA is all about energy. Mitochondria are the powerhouse of our cells. You can't survive without them. They have a very specialized task and they need much, much, much less DNA to do that task. So we're just going to focus in on that mitochondrial DNA. All of us, all humans, every race, every person on the planet has within 120 differences in that DNA of each other. There are only 120 collective differences amongst all humans. Mm-hmm. From what we've recovered from the star child, it's going to end up having between 800 and 1,000 differences. Wow. So 120 amongst all humans and 800 to 1,000 differences in the star child. It's just off the charts difference. So even though there are elements of it that are human or human enough to be recognized, there's just no way to say that it had a human mother. So yes, you're right. Both parents are definitely on the table now.
So I'm obviously not an expert in DNA testing, but how is it possible that there could be elements of human mitochondrial DNA, which would give evidence to suggest the mother was human, if it is, you know, the alternative, which is completely foreign to this planet?
Well, think about it. We humans share genetic material with just about everything on this planet. We're whatever it is, 95% the same as a gorilla, 60% the same as a rat. To be alive on this planet requires your body to be able to synthesize certain proteins, to do certain things, to deal with certain elements and minerals that exist on this planet. Mm-hmm. It makes sense that if you have something that's going to be able to survive on this planet, it's going to have some of those same characteristics. Now, when we're talking about this mitochondrial DNA, your entire genome, everything that makes you, is about 3 billion base pairs. A base pair is every step in the ladder of DNA. So if you picture the double helix ladder, each step is a base pair. Just the mitochondrial DNA is 16,569 of those base pairs. So basically 16,500 versus 3 billion. Mm-hmm. So it's a much smaller, much more concentrated part of your DNA. So that's not to say that there couldn't be an alien species out there that is radically different from us, not a single skerrick of their DNA, anything like ours, but right. The odds are it probably wouldn't be able to survive or do well on this planet at all. It wouldn't have what it needs to be able to cope here. Mm-hmm. So if you have an alien being living here that's managing, that's surviving, that's eating, that's going on, then it seems pretty reasonable to us that it would have some elements of its DNA that are the same. And when we're talking about some elements, we're only talking about 30 to 50 of those base pairs, of those steps in the ladder, out of 16,500 that were recovered in 2003. Just small little segments of it that are very human or human-like. And in between those segments that are human or human-like, we have radical differences, things that no human could survive. If my DNA was like that, I would be dead so fast. We just cannot function, cannot survive if our DNA was as different as the star child's DNA is already turning out to be. We've only got about 10% of that 16,500. But nonetheless, it's enough that we can see already you, me, any normal human could not survive if it had the differences we've already found in the star child skull's DNA.
Fair. Do you think there's a way to, let's assume the star child skull is alien, is there a way to map a new species' genome from the star child?
Oh, absolutely. That's actually our goal.
Current
the
goal.
Testing that we've done so far is very preliminary. What we want to do is recover the entire genome, which you recall took years when they were doing it for humans.
Right.
But now that they've kind of worked the kinks out of that system, it's really only a 1 to 2 year process. So the next thing for us is to get the funding that we need to complete the entire genome recovery and see exactly how similar and how different it is from human. It's already well off the charts. It's already different enough that I think anyone would be confident calling it a different species. Remember, every human has only 120 differences. We've only got 10% of the star child's genome, well, 9.5%. We've already found 93 differences in there. So if we don't find a single other difference, we're already well past the point of calling it a new species. Neanderthals, which are very clearly a different species, they only have 200 differences from the baseline, from which humans have 120 differences. So that 80 is enough to call Neanderthals a new species. We've got 93 already in the star child. So if Neanderthals are different species, the star child skulls are different species at the very least. And
right.
We think much more likely a completely alien life form.
Is the chemistry that makes up the bone, are there any differences between that and normal bone that we know of between, you know, humans or animal?
It's made of the same general stuff as human bones are made out of. The balance of the different minerals within the bone is a little different. It seems to have much more collagen, just gram for gram, than human bone would have in the order of 2 to 3 times as much. Now, that's very interesting. I don't know if you're aware of this, but collagen is absolutely essential to the healing process. So the fact that it has so much more collagen makes us wonder maybe it had some extra kind of healing ability that perhaps we don't have. In terms of the biochemistry of the bone, it's actually pretty similar to tooth enamel, but somehow manages to be more flexible than tooth enamel. So that's what makes us so very, very interested in these fibers. We're extremely excited about what we can do in the future medically with the information that we're going to get out of the star child skull's bone. We like to think that one day we'll be able to really benefit humanity from what comes out of this skull. That at this stage, it's hard to know. Absolutely nothing could end up coming out of it. But the fact that this being was able to live and survive with such incredible differences really opens up the playing field for what can be done, what can be accomplished, and that we're very interested to see how that pans out once we're able to get the genome recovered.
Yeah. Now, the mine that it was found in, has it been completely explored for any type of other artifact or any type of other weird anomalous stuff down there?
Actually, no. We have never mounted an expedition down there to try and find the mine shaft that the girl recovered the skulls from.
Hmm.
She claims that she took both full skeletons with her and lost the skeletons. She was only able to hold on to the skulls. There was a flood and she lost the other bones, but she was able to recover the skulls. So there could be a ravine in Mexico somewhere with the entire rest of these skeletons in there, or there could be dozens of others in that same mine tunnel. We just don't know. And unfortunately, with the current instability in that area, we're not really eager to go down there. And it just seems a little dangerous for us at the moment. But that's definitely something that we're very interested in doing in the future.
Yeah, I mean, that's to me was one of the things I've never heard asked, and I always wondered, because it seems like, you know, here's a pinpointed location where something this crazy has been found, and now that seems like the place to explore.
Well, it's a very large pinpoint. We have a general area southwest of Chihuahua in the Copper Canyon region. We don't know exactly what mine tunnel, and there are thousands of them in that area, so it would be a very arduous expedition to go and to find and explore each of these mine tunnels. So it's a very substantial time commitment and financial commitment to be able to go and do it. So right now we're just focusing on the one that we have in hand, and we'll worry about trying to find the two in the bush down the road.
What are the other goals of the Starchild project besides obviously trying to map some type of genome from this skull?
Well, that really is the all-encompassing goal right now. Yeah. We want to get the entire genome from the skull and tell everyone what we have. We intend to actually make documentary films about the testing process, about everything that's come out of the skull. We really believe that this could be the first absolute, undisputable, solid, tangible evidence of aliens visiting planet Earth.
Right.
Now, that's not to say that we operate at the exclusion of every other possibility, but we, as far as we can tell, that is the direction that all of the facts are pointing. And instead of ruling it out offhand, because, you know, that's what crazy people wearing tinfoil hats think, mm-hmm. we're prepared to explore that possibility. And if that's what it is, everyone needs to know about this. This is going to be so significant to everything, to everyone on this planet, that we want to give as many people as possible an opportunity to inform themselves, to be aware of it, to have happen whatever good can come out of this.
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously tons of stories of visitation. A lot of people suggest that all religions were based on visitation, beings coming from the sky. But outside of the Starchild skull, have you seen any other, like, what's the next most compelling evidence you've heard of alien visitation or have seen, or is there any other skull or bones found anywhere?
Well, there is a lot of compelling anecdotal and film evidence, but as far as bones go, I would say the next likely candidate is the conehead skulls in Peru. There are a number of skulls that are clearly human that have just been artificially deformed. They wrap cloths around the skull and force them into kind of a conehead shape. But then there are hundreds, literally hundreds of other skulls where the bone is twice as thick as normal human bone. The eye sockets are a little different. The jaws are different. And most significantly, there is twice as much brain inside that skull. And there are hundreds of these. These are clearly not any kind of human as we currently understand it. There's no evidence of artificial head binding on any of them. They are just absolutely off the charts different. So that would be the next thing that we would like to investigate. And in fact, my associate Lloyd Pye has already taken the steps of working with people inside Peru, with the scientific community there, on moving forward with that testing process.
I mean the skull, to me, it does look like a typical, like, gray alien from, you know, what the composite that most people have put together you know, through Hollywood and stuff, and it really is fascinating. I think the skull is so crazy, and the fact that people try to dismiss it as, you know, this condition or that condition, it's all kind of null and void when you look at the fibers. Apparently the brain capacity is larger, the thickness of the skull. Those are all things that those aren't related, going to be related to any disease.
Well, there was actually a girl that we worked with a number of years ago who wanted to do her university thesis on the Starchild skull. And she started out doing a very serious analysis of it. And then she got the word from her professors that if you don't start discrediting this thing pretty quick, we're going to fail you. And so she, from that point, went and found, I think she ended up with about 24 different conditions that if somehow a person had all 24 of these conditions, they would be kind of like the Starchild skull. Unfortunately, those conditions contraindicated each other. So it would have been absolutely impossible, but nonetheless, that was the closest anyone's ever come to being able to explain it. I guarantee you and your listeners that if this had an easy answer, we would love to find it. We have been looking for that for years, but there just isn't anything out there that explains it. If you say, okay, the skull is this shape and the eye sockets are so shallow because it had pressure inside the skull, well, that would be great if there was any evidence of that whatsoever. In fact, we have evidence from CAT scans that there was no unusual pressure inside the skull. Anything that you can name, there is a reason why it's absolutely impossible. And there are still the naysayers out there, and that's fine. They're welcome to keep believing that. But people who really take the time to look at the evidence are always just amazed. That's how we've managed to get such an incredibly reputable team on our side working on this, even often to the mockery of their colleagues, just because they can see how incredibly different, how very important this skull is to the world of science and to the future of the human race.
Well, elaborating on that, are you facing resistance from the academic and scientific communities? Is there a reluctance to look at this thing seriously?
Oh, always. It's been an enormous hurdle for us. For every one person that really pays attention and looks at the evidence and says, okay, let's get some more information before I make a decision, there are 100 people who make a snap decision without even looking at it in many cases, without doing any research, without looking at any of the research that we've done, and they'll just say offhandedly, it's a deformity, or it's this, or it's that, or nature can do anything, and you're just barking up the wrong tree. And that's what is so exciting to us about the DNA, because you can't argue with DNA. There is a lot we don't understand about nuclear DNA, the 3 billion base pairs. There is about 95% of that we really don't know exactly what it does. But the mitochondrial DNA, the 16,500 that we already have 9.5% of, that had the 93 differences in it already, that doesn't have great swaths that we don't understand. That is some of the most highly conserved genetic material that exists within the human body. If very much goes wrong within that part of your DNA, you just can't survive. It is so crucial, and now we have very solid evidence that within that crucial, can't be changed part of the DNA, we have changes that no one has ever seen before. We've really finally got the kind of evidence that we need to be able to put down the naysayers once and for all.
Right. Is the Starchild skull up for display anywhere?
Unfortunately, it's not. We have replicas that we take with us to conferences and events like that, but the real skull has a number of large sections cut out of it for different testing that has been done over the course of the last 12 years. And so we intend, once all is said and done, to get those large missing sections repaired and then hope to display it at a museum somewhere. But for the moment, it's in such bad shape, and we're returning to it so often to get new samples, that there's no way to really display it effectively.
Right. Man, because I would love to see that. I'm sure a lot of people would.
Well, the next best thing is the Starchild Project website, www.starchildproject.com. There is a ton of free information there for anyone that's interested. You'll find most of your questions are answered, but if they're not, we always love to hear from people.
Yeah, it's a great website. I love the video that's right up in the front. It outlines a lot of the differences between the skull and normal human skulls. I think it's awesome to hear that, you know, you guys are on your way to mapping some type of genome from this. I'm sure obviously it's going to take a long time. How did you originally get involved with the project yourself?
Well, I've been with the project since 2004, and I actually came on initially as the webmaster and have just stuck with it ever since, doing whatever needed to be done, and now I'm their chief of operations, still pretty much just doing whatever needs to be done.
Very cool. Are you guys finding, with the reluctance from the scientific community, are you having a hard time getting the proper funding?
It is difficult, yes. Part of the problem is that we aren't yet to the point of publishing anything in a peer-reviewed journal. We've had a number of informal reports done, but the process of going through and getting it published in one of those papers can literally take years. It's very arduous. You need to have things proven to a level of certainty that we will absolutely have once we complete the genome testing, but at this point our findings are preliminary. So it's difficult to publish a findings report when you don't have your completed findings. That does make things difficult for us. But what we've found, and the reason we have that policy of disclosing information as soon as it's available to us, is that most people out there really don't care about whether you've used enough big words or how many different PhDs have looked at it. They're perfectly happy with one PhD and just the facts, just the information. And so that's what we're doing right now. We're just focusing on getting those facts out to people as easily and as quickly as we can.
That's fair. And I hope that this interview helps that process along in its own little way. And Amy, before I let you go, I've kind of got to challenge you a little bit, because where I am pretty much accepting of anything that makes life a little more interesting, a friend of mine, Hermo, and frequent guest of the show, takes a little more skeptical approach to these types of situations. And when I told him I was going to be having you on, he researched the website and sent me his opinion on the situation, which I'd like to read for you and give you a chance to respond if you don't object.
Hopefully
please
do.
You give me some answers. Okay, well, great. While he does admit the skull is strange and pretty unexplainable, he adds this: "The main thing that I find really strange about the situation is that Mr. Pye talks consistently about how the skull and the research surrounding it is being completely shunned by the academic science elite. He chalks his ideas up as another one of those compelling paranormal finds that science ignores, and that suggestion sounds absolutely preposterous to me. There's a whole lot of scientists in this world who spend their entire adult lives digging in the ground hoping to find something interesting. If this find is genuine, it doesn't make any sense that scientists wouldn't be jumping over one another to study it for themselves. If you had a strange, really old-looking skull, I guarantee you could walk into any properly outfitted university biology department in the country and say, 'I want to know if this is human,' and you'd find an eager person who will run the PCR on the DNA for free. Yet Mr. Pye acts like everyone is avoiding his skull because of some ingrained scientific bias, and that he has to jump through hoops to get anyone to look at it. And of course, he needs people to donate to his site so he can pay to have the tests run, and that's why I don't like it." That's obviously a very skeptical view, but that was the most damning of what he had to say. He did admit it is very odd, and there is no answer. And there, you know, with testing, if it was human, there should be an answer.
Well, no, absolutely, and I fully respect everyone's right to their opinion, and that's what I thought too. My first contact with the project was writing Mr. Pye an email saying, "You've got to be joking. If this was a real thing, then I work in an archaeology department. I'm sure that they would love to do this testing for you, but this is obviously a hoax because you're asking for donations." Well, that's true. We do ask for donations to maintain the site. If anyone would like to donate a couple of $1 million, we'll be more than happy to do the DNA testing. But it's certainly not a lap of luxury kind of thing. It would be a lot nicer for me if it was, but we really do use the donations for testing, for maintenance of the website, for very legitimate things to do with the testing process. I can understand the concerns, but anyone who's ever actually tried to do this can tell you that's not how it works at all. It is a very competitive environment. There is only a certain amount of funding available for a certain amount of things, and if you don't fit into whatever the flavor of the month happens to be, you're going to have a really hard time getting that funding. We have tried taking this. In fact, before I came on board with it, Mr. Pye extensively tried to take this to various universities and other places to have it tested, to have the work done. We're just so completely idiotic that there's an easy solution, and we're just stumbling around for 12 years without trying it. I respect his right to his opinion, but this is one of those things where it should be that easy. Science should be willing to tackle anything that it comes across. And I'm not talking about individual people. I'm talking about the establishment of mainstream mm-hmm. science as almost a religion, where certain things have to be adhered to, certain steps have to be followed. If you aren't willing to follow every one of those steps precisely, because this was found by a tourist instead of being part of an archaeological dig, because Mr. Pai is indeed quite outspoken about this, there is a host of reasons that make it more attractive for people to shun it than to actually do any investigation into it. And I would love if your friend wrote in, a friend who frequents the show. Well, sir, I'm so glad that you do listen in and that you are listening in today. But if you are able to find a university that is willing to do this, it's ancient DNA testing, it's fairly complicated, it's fairly expensive. If you find us a lab willing to do it, that would be fantastic. Please get in touch with us. The contact information's on the website. We would absolutely love to hear from you or any reputable institution that you have that is willing to undertake this testing.
Well, there you go, Hermo. You know, the challenge has been set. It's not an opinion I agree with, but I felt like if I didn't at least include it, I would be doing them a disservice.
I'm sure there are plenty of people thinking the same thing, because I certainly did. I couldn't believe that everyone wouldn't be jumping all over it. And it's because in a lot of ways we went through the wrong channels to begin with. And if it was easy to go through the right channels, I'm sure that that's what they would have done. But we have tried over more than a decade now, just about everything you can think of. And all I can say is, if there's a way to get it done, let us know. We'll be more than happy to take on the suggestion.
Well, Amy, I really appreciate you coming on the show. I advise everyone to take a look at the skull. I'm obviously going to have to include some pictures with it. It is a really interesting find, and so far unexplainable. And I wish you guys the best on your quest to blow this thing up and get people talking about it.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on.